On today's episode of Talk to Tea, we welcome Linda Hunter. Linda is an independent writer, published author, and event planner who is dedicated to service, open to possibility, and who aspires to walk a path of grace. Passionate about life and death, her latest adventure is creating an intentional community with her husband and grown children that includes sharing more, taking less, and being led back to the land and to each other. Linda is the co-visionary behind Deathly Matters, an annual two-day online community conference showcasing emerging voices and perspectives dedicated to doing death better. Linda remarks, "You've lived an extraordinary life. Why wouldn't you live to have an extraordinary death?" Makes total sense. I'm excited to have this discussion with Linda. So let's go. Hey, Linda Hunter, welcome to Talk to Tea. We're so excited to host you here.
Thanks, Tracy. I'm so honored to be here and thanks so much. And I'm so thrilled to be sharing space with you today.
Amazing. And speaking of space, you have a beautiful space behind you.
Yes, I'm very lucky. I have to say I'm very grateful. I have, I've been living here 7 weeks now, just about 20 kilometers just outside of Souk near French Beach, for those who know Vancouver Island. And we are in the woods. So I am surrounded by trees and lots of glass so that I can see them.
Beautiful. Yeah, it's from over here, it's like inside or outside inside living.
Exactly our intention. Yes, yes.
Lovely. And
because we're on one level, we're a no step entry, single level house. You are literally walking indoors and outdoors all the time. So it's beautiful, beautiful way to live.
Wow. Amazing. And speaking of intentional living, we're going to get to that in just a moment, but you are the co-visionary for a very extraordinary, what could we call it? A conference?
Yes, we call it a conference.
Yeah. Called Deathly Matters.
That's right. I'm the co-visionary. Yes. Along with Shonda Jans from Sacred Grief.
Amazing. Would you share a little bit about the impetus behind you creating that? And then, you know, maybe give us a snapshot of it, like the journey that you were on and rolling that out. And yeah, and several, you know, it became an annual thing for several years.
Sure, I'd love to. Thank you. So to be honest, it's been a really long journey, starting way back for as long as I can remember. Now that I look back for as long as I can remember, there have been all kinds of instances in my life where death showed up. And you know, when you're in something, you don't really recognize it, but often years later and you reflect and you're maybe working on a project or interested in something, you think, oh yeah, this has actually been with me for a very long time. So for a number of years, all through my teens and in my early 20s, I was involved with death in lots of ways. So young death with someone who died by suicide, a good friend of mine in grade 8, all the way through. And of course, pets dying when I was a child and that sort of thing, all the way through to one of my first conferences. I'm a conference planner. So one of the first conferences that I held, one of my delegates died on the conference in Singapore on a national holiday. So I've had all kinds of instances, including friends and family, of course, who have passed. And so that has informed me throughout the years in terms of my own passing and my thoughts around death as I get older. And so what happened to me was a number of years back after we had moved to Vancouver Island, my mother-in-law, who was only 59 at the time, actually my father-in-law first. So my father-in-law was diagnosed with cancer and lived a very short time from his diagnosis. And basically we didn't really have time to catch our breath. So we were told that he was terminally ill and he died actually within weeks. So really didn't even have time to adjust, right? And he lived far away from us. So it was some back and forth traveling and such. Fast forward only a few months, and now my mother-in-law, who is as well 59 years old, same as my father-in-law, and we are now living here on Vancouver Island, is diagnosed as well, terminally ill, stage 4 cancer. And so we go back to visit my mother-in-law to have a conversation with the doctors and our family and to make a plan, right? Because this is sort of what you think about at the end of life. We need to make a plan if we haven't made one already. And in this case, there was no plan, not at 59, unexpected. And what happened was we went from a quick diagnosis and a 2-week visit to actually changing our lives and moving back to Toronto, outside of Toronto, for 8 months to take care of my mother-in-law. She actually said to us, you know, please don't let me die alone. I have my, she had her daughter, my sister-in-law at the time, but she said to us, please stay with me. So we actually changed our lives. We took our children out of school. We moved back and we spent 8 months caring for her, taking her through the process of chemo and all of the other things that go with, you know, selling a house and making a plan for end of life. Mm. And what occurred to me throughout the 8 months that I was with her was that not only could we not really talk about what was happening because she couldn't accept it, and a number of us, you know, were struggling with it as well, but there was no plan in place. There was no advance plan in place. There was no discussion about what type of funeral, what type of service, how did my mother-in-law want to be buried or cremated? We weren't allowed to talk about it because she wasn't in a place where she could cope. She was trying to adjust herself, right? Mm-hmm. So we went through the process of chemo and then planning for a funeral and selling her house and doing the delicate dance of what do we ask? When do we ask it? What's a good day? What's not a good day? When is it appropriate? What's not okay to ask? And the entire time that I was with my mother-in-law, I was really aware of this is not how I would want it to be. This is not how I think it should be. This is not a beautiful way to die, right? And she'd lived the most life in her 59 years. And I felt like we were missing an opportunity to have a really beautiful death together. So after my mother-in-law died, this was still with me. After my mother-in-law died, I was living with my folks, my own parents. And my father was diagnosed years later. My father was diagnosed with leukemia. And I walked my father alongside my father through that journey. And we had a very different experience. And for me and for him, it was a really beautiful experience. And it wasn't nearly as sad, right? Because we were able to talk and laugh and he was able to express how he felt. And my father held an audience. I don't know who he thought he was, but my father actually held an audience with a number of people, gave me a list and said, these people need to be called and they need to come and see me and I need to tell them how I feel. So we had a number of people come over the, you know,
amazing. Last 6 months.
Yeah. And my dad actually sat people down with a cup of tea and said, this is what you've meant to me. His nephew flew in from New York. It was amazing, actually. And it was really, you know, such a contrast in experiences. And I knew then that this was more the direction I wanted to go in, right? So I continued my life. We were raising children. We were busy. And then, you know, a number of years later, my mother had a number of heart attacks. And after her third heart attack, so my mom had by this time lived with us almost 20 years. Mm-hmm. My mother had a third heart attack and we were told the next heart attack will likely take your mother. And again, we had the talks. We had the laughs. We talked about what my mom wanted. And my mom was a really cool, funny, smart woman. And so nothing was, you know, no discussion was taboo. So even at the dinner table with our kids, my mom was talking about, I want this kind of music. I want to make sure that we have this kind of cake. I want a picture of me it looks a lot slimmer than I look now. You know, like she just... told us what she wanted. And then the whole process right through to the end, I have a beautiful blog post that I've written about my mom's life and death right to the end. You know, my mom's final two sentences before she died were, you've been an awesome daughter and I've had a fantastic ride.
Oh,
it doesn't get better than that. It just doesn't.
No, it doesn't.
And I felt really wonderful and gifted and so happy with the way my mom died. If you can be happy, you know, I miss her terribly, but I was so aware of how different it was from my mother-in-law. So as soon as my mom had died, I thought I really need to do something in death. Like there has to be a way to talk to people about this because our culture is age phobic and death phobic. We don't want to talk about death, right? Even when we're dying, we don't want to talk about death, right?
So true.
So I enrolled in a program at the Saanich Peninsula Hospital, our local hospital, and I volunteered in palliative care for 3.5 years and talked to people. And while I was in that process, sort of beside me or, you know, in another part of town type thing, Shauna Jans, the co-creator for Deathly Matters, was putting together a number of people to talk about death, to have an open conversation. And she started the Victoria Holistic Death Care Group. It was amazing. We would meet every 6 weeks in a circle. Anybody could come and we literally just talked about death and what it could look like and how we could do death better. That was sort of our thing. How can we do death better? And from that, we figured out we need a conference. There isn't a conference. There are lots of conferences for practitioners, but there wasn't anything for the community, for your neighbor, for your sister and you to be able to go and share some time. And we also wanted to get back to a culture where death is normal and okay, and we can die at home, and we can build our own casket, and we can have a green burial, and we can, you know, look at the barriers, and we can look at grief for what it is. And so we decided to create a conference that showcased the emerging, different emerging perspectives around death and dying. So outside the mainstream.
And amazing.
Yeah, we started it 3 years ago.
Amazing.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's been a beautiful journey.
Amazing. Man, I just heard so much in your share that I, you know, like want to pick up the thread of and tell me more about this. So maybe we'll go thread by thread a little here, just so we can, you know, I can pick your brain a little on this subject. So I really heard you saw the contrast between like resisting death versus owning or accepting your death.
Absolutely.
Even if it, you know, we all know we're dying daily and that we're headed toward our death, inevitable. And you're so right. It's the resistance to that.
Yes. Fact. Yes.
Yeah. That actually creates the upset. I really heard that in your story.
Yeah.
And that was the difference for you, hey?
Yeah. And you know what? When I went to see my father-in-law, I was just absolutely sobbing when I went into his hospital room. And he waited for me to finish crying and said, "Are you done?" And I said, "Yeah, I'm done for the moment." And I said to him, "I just don't get it. Like, you seem so okay with this. It's been like 5 weeks, right? You seem okay." And he said to me, "You know what, Linda? Resistance is what makes things hard. Acceptance paves a path of grace." Oh. And honestly, my father-in-law was not that type of guy. Like, I never thought I'd hear something like that from him. But honestly, we didn't talk about his death, but he did not fight it. He just said to me, "Take care of your mother-in-law. Please be with her. She needs you." And that was it. And we never spoke again about his death. And he died only a number of weeks later. But I never forgot that sentence because I aspire to walk a path of grace. So for him to use those words for me, I was like, yes, it is true. Resistance is what makes things hard. We weren't going to be able to change that outcome. It was about how we embraced it. And we did.
Amazing.
At least I did. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, and you brought up the other point. What a beautiful quote, first of all, you know, to leave you with and to use such a, you know, a sacred word, because I know that word grace. I mean, you just exude grace anyways, but that is, that's an amazing moment and an amazing memory to have during a challenging and tricky time.
Yes.
Talk to us about myself and all the keen listeners that we have about that part of, you spoke to it, sobbing, grief struck. That's the part for me that's always tricky. You know, I'm an emotional, you know, like the depths of my emotions are profound. I mean, I cry when a leaf falls from the tree. And so for me, that, you know, profound grieving, and currently I have several people in my life, and I could tear up even in this moment talking about it. How do you overcome that? Or I don't know if it's overcome is the appropriate word.
Yeah.
Or I think it's be with it.
Yes. I was just going to say, I don't really think about it in terms of overcoming it. I think of it in terms of it being with us. And actually, I think of it as staying with us. So I think that what we used to think, or maybe, you know, our culture, or maybe the way I was raised, and not even with my parents, but just societal, was sort of that grief was a moment in time and it happened when something happened. So something would happen that would be sad or for whatever reason, a loss, and would invoke grief. And then it would last for this amount of time. And then the grief ends and then you go on. And I think we've come a long way, you know, from that sort of old way of thinking. And my understanding in my heart is that I feel like I'm always grieving something. It could be the climate. It could be to do with COVID. It could be to do with friends and family who are struggling. It could be, it could be leaving a place.
Mm-hmm.
It could be leaving a relationship. It could be leaving a house. It could be leaving a job, right? I think there are lots and lots of losses. And for me, I think it's more about welcoming it and becoming really comfortable with it and just making sure that we have the support we need, that we are surrounded and uplifted in our grief. And I think that we now I hope we're coming to a place of understanding that grief does not have a timeline and it does not have a right or wrong way about it, and that it is personal and it is your own. And I think we need to learn to sit with it and not be in such a hurry to move away from it or to get it, you know, to get beyond it, right? Or to get over it. I just don't think it, I don't think it's possible. And I don't think it's healthy to have to go beyond it. I don't see why we can't incorporate it into our lives and find a place for it. And just to make sure that we are doing what we need to do to take care of ourselves and those around us so that we are supported. I think that's the important thing. And to reach out, you know, that's one of the things we talk about at Deathly Matters is we are not alone. We are not meant to be alone. And we need to be able to reach out. And there are all kinds of wonderful, wonderful people and resources now available to us. I lost my nephew in 2018 to an accident. He died by accident and he was only 16. And it was a big sort of well-known case. It was in the papers and he was a disabled teen. Yeah. He had Duchenne muscular dystrophy and he died in a sailing accident in Victoria. And I remember when my sister-in-law first, you know, got the news and then went to the hospital and went through the whole process. She witnessed it, his accident and witnessed his death. And I remember coming to the house the next morning and I literally could hear the wailing of my sister-in-law from the street. From the street, I could hear her. Mm-hmm. And I came in and I laid beside her and I listened and I held her. And then I went out and I got busy because I knew there were things that I could do to help people who were now coming to the door and people who were sitting in the space. And I remember, and I'm sure my brother would be okay with me sharing this, but I remember my brother saying to me, he was very concerned about how loud she was in the house and how distraught she was. And he said to me, I think we need to phone someone. Like, I think we need to get some help. We need to figure out how to help her. And I phoned Shauna. I thought, I'm going to phone Shauna Jans. She'll know what to do and she'll know what to tell me so that I can tell others. And I phoned her and I said to her, this is what's happening in this house. And she said to me, wow, this is amazing and beautiful and right. Because she is in her body physically manifesting and feeling all the feelings of losing her son who she loved so much. And she said, she is doing what we should be doing in our culture. We're so often like, we stop it and we get busy and we don't want to talk about it, or we put on a brave face, or we just, you know, get busy doing. And she said, what is she doing? She's literally laying in her grief on her bed, unable to move and literally wailing. And that went on for 3 days before my sister-in-law came out of her beautiful room and walked into her son's room and then continued. And we just continued to bring her water and bring her food and lay beside her and be with her, meet her where she was at. And I thought,
that's so beautiful.
What a great, she was teaching me literally in that moment, this is grief, right?
Yeah.
This is what it looks like. And you know, now we're in 2021.
And it's so unique for everyone, hey?
Absolutely. It's such a personal journey. And and that's why there is no timeline and no right or wrong. And I think we just need to learn to not judge and not determine for others what the timeline is and just be there and ask people, what do you need? Right?
Yes.
What do you need?
Yeah. Yeah.
Yes.
I love your approach in terms of, you know, let's call, is it Kathy that you said?
I call Shauna.
Oh, sorry. I apologize.
Yeah.
Shauna.
Yeah. I call Shauna.
And, you know, it's almost like instinctively you are giving yourself, you probably had an idea of that, hey, this is what it looks like for this individual. We just need to be with it. But there's that permission from, you know, with someone else. Yeah. Got your back. This is it. And so I think for people that haven't necessarily, you know, done the journey with such intention as you have, with eyes wide open and eyes wide open to the learning of it, that there is that tendency to, am I doing the right thing? This should not be, that wailing should not, you know, there's the alarm first. And then that great sense of responsibility of, what if we're not doing the right thing here and we should be doing something else? And what I hear you saying is, be with it exactly as it is, walk with it, allow it and that individual to teach you. What is right for them might occur from the outside, wrong for us, or unusual, not necessarily right, wrong, but unusual, or, and allow them to teach.
Yes, and I think, yeah, exactly. And yes, and thank you for putting it so beautifully. And I think too, we always want to fix things. We always want to make things better. And all, and not everything needs to be fixed. And also not everything can be fixed. And it's okay. It's okay to sit with something that's really uncomfortable. We're not so good at uncomfortable. We like everything to be nice and packaged and go a certain way, or actually go our way, the way that we think it's meant to go. And so we're uncomfortable with silence. We're uncomfortable with people crying in our presence. We're uncomfortable with people being uncomfortable. And I think that's on us. That's for us to learn, right? We need to learn. And that is why I feel so grateful that my sister-in-law was teaching me in that moment, this is okay.
Yeah.
And this is the way it is right now. And we just have to sit with it, right? And hold space for her and hold space for anyone else, right? And also take care of ourselves.
Yeah.
Take care of ourselves so that we can be there, because we're no good to anyone else if we're not taking care of ourselves, right?
Yeah. Absolutely. I just finished the 7 days with Gabor Maté, Dr. Gabor Maté.
Oh, yes.
And the wisdom of trauma.
Oh,
and
trauma. You
know, as you're talking about your, you know, the wailing, two things happen in my mind. Well, a lot more than that because of the way my mind works. But the two that I'll, you know, sort of like reflect, and that is one, other cultures wail. You know,
yes,
there's a lot of across the world, there is that permission, and that is a natural part of grieving and loss. So there, that piece came to mind. And then we didn't all originate where we are now. And, you know, over generations and multi-generations, like who knows where we actually traveled from to arrive where we are now, that culture isn't deep within us. And those instincts, you know, in our most tender of moment, just might emerge naturally. So there was kind of that thinking of, and, you know, it makes perfect sense that wailing would move. But the Gabor Maté piece too was that, you know, what I'm really learning about trauma is that occurs within the body.
Yes.
It's a rejigging of our whole central nervous system, and things like humming and tapping and moving the body back to or tuning is actually, that is healing. And so it occurred to me, wailing is a body experience. I have wailed with grief, and that experience is really, it's cathartic. Something shifts. And it's not just a one area shift, it's a whole body experience.
Absolutely. And what I felt in that moment was that my sister-in-law was really connected to herself, connected to her body. And I think many of us are disconnected to our bodies. Oh. We don't listen. We don't, you know, if you're familiar with Gabor Maté, you know, he wrote When the Body Says No, which I think is...
Yeah.
It's such, like, it's the perfect phrase, right? You can fake it all you want. You can pretend that life is good and you like your job and you're okay with the person you sleep next to and everything's fine. And your body will do the work for you if you're not willing to or can't for some reason accept what's really how you really feel and you're not authentic. Your body is authentic and it will break down and it, you know, and you'll get the migraines or you'll get the disease or you won't be able to move or whatever it is, because the body is real and in touch and in tune. And that's what my sister-in-law was. She was in tune and really connected to herself. Yeah.
Yeah.
I think we need to get back to that in many ways.
Yeah. 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 Profound. And what an incredible in facing, you know, death, what an incredible opportunity to, if you do anything before you take your last breath, but to reconnect to you, to your essence, to who you were born as, separate from the external world. Like, what an amazing parting gift.
Yes. And to me, that's part of a beautiful death.
Nice. Yeah.
Is that you leave this place in your truest form, right? And if you can have a say in how that all looks as well, then even better, right? Yeah. And when you speak to other cultures, that's what I think about. You know, my mom grew up in the UK, and when her grandfather died, he was put in the chair in the corner of the living room, and people came in and they had a drink and the fire was on, and her grandfather was sitting there, right? And nobody was afraid of that. And small children came in and kissed him goodbye. And other cultures have really embraced this idea of acceptance with death. And we're just a little bit, Sean and I say, we're just a little bit behind that. We just need to catch up, right?
Yeah.
Our culture, our North American culture needs to catch up. And we need to learn from other cultures that it's okay. And death is not something that happens to you. It's part from the moment you're born. You are already dying, right? It's part of life. Yeah. It's part of life. Yeah. And if there's a way to embrace it and even be almost not happy, but okay with it, I think what a beautiful way to go, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. Yeah,
absolutely.
Which makes me think that you need to be working all the way through your life, living your best, most authentic, truest, kindest life that you can, walking in purpose, so that you can have a better death. I think that's part of why people struggle at the end, right? They haven't lived the way they wanted to live. It's not just the way they're dying. They haven't lived the way they wanted to live, right?
Yeah. Yeah. It's like you read my mind, because I was actually going to ask you about that. Is that it occurred to me as we were talking about this that it makes perfect sense that we would now suddenly, if we are willing to accept our death and impending, and that we don't actually know our expiry date, then it would be impetus to lead our best life, like life unstoppable and on fire.
Absolutely.
We get a bit arrogant with our life, I would say, and I'm generalizing. I know there's, you know, certainly myself, and I know you live with extreme intention. But I think that, you know, we might generalize that there are some that squander, and, you know, they're waiting for the right time to launch the career, or waiting for the right time to be happy, or, you know, and it occurred to me with an acceptance of our impending death that it might actually support us to shake that off.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And I think that for many people, many of us live a fear-based life, where we make our decisions not just based on fear, but or out of fear, but what other people think we should be doing, what society says is the right thing to be doing. And I think we also want to play it safe often, right? And we don't want to take risks. And again, that speaks to fear. And so I think that what happens is, if you live your life like that and you get to the end, you have those regrets that, you know, Tuesdays with Maury and all these sort of famous books and movies have been written, where, and if you've read those books, and if you've watched those films, and if you've talked to anyone who's at end of life, which I have, and many of us have, they do say those same things. I should have, you know, gone with how I felt. I should have taken more risks. I should have called my brother. Yeah. I should have not worried so much about money. I should have had more adventure, right? And that's what people said to me, even in palliative care. You know, when I would sit with people and we would read or chat or play a game or do whatever, that's what they would say. Man, if I had my time again, I would do this and this and this.
Yeah.
And I have never wanted to live that way. I have always wanted, you know, we're here, most of us, less than 100 years. It's a really short time. And so why would you not want to fill that doing all the things that not only you want to do, but all the things that are teaching you so that you can evolve into your best self? So that by the time you get to the end, however long or short that is, you can say, I lived the life that I was meant to live, or that I was guided or spirit led, or that I wanted to live.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Beautiful.
Yeah. Yeah. And so for me, throughout my life, because I, you know, when I started talking about death and even looking at the conference people, or even this new way that we're living here, people would say, but it's so morbid and you're so young. Why are you looking at that? And I said, it's not morbid. Imagine it. If you can imagine this really wonderful life and a really great ending, and you think about what does that look like for you, and you ask yourself those questions, and you try to plan. I know we can't plan for everything, obviously, but if you make a plan and you put that all in place, then what you actually can do is just let it go. And then you can just go on living, knowing that the plan is in place, and hopefully it might go that way, or you'll have some say in some part of it, right? And so that's how we've designed our lives, my husband and I, and with our children, sort of all the way along to the point now where we are in our final home, where we will age in place and die at home. I hope to die among the trees in nature, and we've built a house that will work with us, right? So we have had those hard conversations about what if we're in a wheelchair? What if we're bedridden? What if we need care? Is there a space here for someone to look after or help us, support us? We've asked, you know, can we put in doorknobs that turn a certain way? Can we roll into our shower so we can take care of ourselves personally as far, you know, as long as possible? We built the house with all of that in mind. And now we just enjoy our lives knowing that we don't have stairs to climb if we can't, you know, we have a space for someone to come if they need to care for us, that sort of thing. And then we continue to walk our lives, not making fear-based decisions, but making intentional decisions.
Right.
Yeah.
Wow. I love it. Amazing. I just hear there's just total surrender and acceptance. And I can see it in your face. There's like a sense of peace about you that, you know, people would pay millions to actually have. So I think you're giving away some of the secrets to that in this acceptance and, you know, sharing the journey about this. This is amazing stuff. I want to draw in one piece that you shared with me. And I hear you speaking to it and alluding to it. I hear it in your journey and the people that you've supported along the way. And I think I have an opinion about it, and that is how we relate with or don't relate with at times, how our community is structured, you know, such that we're not actually integrating with elders, but there's a separation in the community. I am so passionate about breaking that up. You know, early there was a program that made me, of course, you know, bawl my eyes out when I saw it begin. I think it began in the UK where they married up, you know, potential grandparents with the kindergartners or brought the kindergartners in. And I thought, yes. Or maybe it began in Sweden. They seem a lot more progressive in terms of those kinds of humanitarian or community-based things. So you said that, you know, our elders are vital to our lives and they bring meaning, wisdom, and grace to the planet. We have a duty to care for them and learn from them.
Wow, did I say that?
You certainly did,
that is how I feel. Yes, yes. And I'll tell you, that's one of the best things that came out of COVID. It shone a light on care homes, long-term care homes, our elders, and that whole watching people not be able to be with their elders or elders not be able to be with their family when they were in those homes during COVID, but also at end of life and not being able to share, you know, being able to hold the hand of your father or whoever's in care, really shone a light on that for me. And, you know, we came to Vancouver Island to live with my parents, to raise our children with their elders. In so many other cultures, this is not new, right? Mm-hmm. For whatever reason, our North American or Western culture seems to think that we're all about privacy and square footage and launching our children by the time they're 17 or 18. And then we're all supposed to be independent. And yes. I have always thought we are supposed to be or meant to be interdependent. Mm. We are meant to walk alongside each other and support each other and be together when we need each other. And of course, go off and do your own thing. But know that there are other people who are not only, you know, in your corner, but also walking alongside you and available to uplift, you know, to lift you up and to support you. So we came to the island 26 years ago or however long ago to raise our children with my parents who were well at the time, young-ish, and didn't need to come into the home for any other reason other than to share the life and share the raising of our children and us, our children to learn from them. And I didn't have elders when I was young. My family is all in the UK. We were a small family. My husband comes from a family living in a small town where everybody is related but all the people he's related to are there. And he would walk along the street and go into his granny's for lunch and he'd see his aunt in the post office and he was connected to his family until he emigrated to Canada. And I didn't have that. And so when we got together at a very young age, it was very important to us that we be with our parents. And since we couldn't be with my husband's parents because they didn't live long lives, they, you know, died early, as I said, we made an intentional decision to raise our children with our other, my parents, or the other set of elders. And so we joined with them early on and they lived in our house and died with us. And our children were part of their everyday life. And that's what I wanted, right? I wanted them to run downstairs when they lost a tooth or when they had something to share. And I wanted my parents to, you know, if they lost a friend, I wanted my children to be there to witness that and for them to share the stories about that. And for my dad to talk about the war and what it was like to be a pilot at 18 years old. Those stories don't get told, don't always get told if you're not there in the everyday. I did not want to just visit my parents on Sunday afternoon for dinner. I needed them in our everyday lives. It was such a gift to have them with us, and also for our children, who now talk a lot about what they learned from their elders. And so it was clear to me, as my parents were getting older and getting closer to death, that we need to then make a plan for ourselves, and that we need to talk to our children about what's next for us. Like, how do we then take that same model or some form of that model, and how do we find a way to support us as we age in place and hopefully die at home? And had the conversation with all of them about, does anyone want to live with us? And not thinking at the time that it would be very similar, but quite different, in that all of our children said, we want to live near you or beside you, but we don't want to live with you. We don't want to, we don't want to be in the same building like you were with our Nana and Pop. And then there was a conversation about, what does that look like? And then we talked about, you know, who would like to care for us, or who feels like they would like to support us. And what was really interesting to me was, in this group of people, my beautiful son-in-law at one point put his hand up or said, well, why is it us or them? Why is it one or some? Why don't we just all live together? And then it's not about aging parents. It's about supporting the people we love. And so now, with this intentional community that we're sort of building on this 10 acres on Vancouver Island, we will all live together, so that when we're gone, they will then continue to support each other. And if children come along, those grandchildren, their children will then support each other and be together, right? And if you'll live independently and privately, you'll have your own business. You know, that was one of the things that a lot of my friends would say is, but you'll be in each other's business. And I would say, no, you have to be clear. You make clear boundaries. You clearly say how you want to live.
Yes.
And you honor that, just like we did with my parents. And you honor that.
Yes.
And then you carry on knowing that you have people who are there to support and uplift you. And I have felt supported by my children and with my children the entire time that they've been growing. And now we're in a place where I feel very comfortable to age and then hopefully die surrounded by them if we're lucky.
Wow. And
then we have all the nuances of all the ages. It's beautiful. It's a beautiful way to live.
It is. And it's a beautiful model that if we were to follow that. Now, there's a few, you know, things you need to make happen, and you touched on those, and I'm, you know, going to bring in a like some points of view that I know people bring up often if I'm talking with people about this conversation. And, you know, our family are in this conversation now. My grandmother is 107 months.
Wow. And
You know, we are a UK family. I was born in Scotland, raised there till I was 10 or just 9, and then turned 10 when we got here. My grandparents live with us all my life. And I had two sets of parents. I always thought it was incredible if my mom and dad were cooking something awful for dinner. I just ran downstairs and had meals with my grandparents. You know, and we had that situation. We're so fortunate. I have an incredible relationship with my grandmother. My grandmother ended up living with me for a time and had the benefit of her great grandchildren, has an incredible relationship with them both, and now our other sons, and so all four of them. And, you know, we are really fortunate, and there is that model. Now my parents care for my grandmother. And they are super, you know, I hope my parents are okay talking about their life, but they're used to me being the podcaster, so anything flies. But, you know, there's the challenge that we talk about often is that, you know, they're doing amazing and my parents are aging, and I am, you know, involved as much as I possibly can, and also have my grandmother come live with us. And we love it. It's not like caring for something. She's extraordinarily fit mentally and physically. And, you know, and we're lucky as a family. However, we're none of us, I think I am, you know, certainly I'm a different, what would I say, personality type. I can handle so much more. There isn't there aren't things that, you know, and I'll be really sort of frank, would disgust me, like changing a diaper, or, you know, I really can do those things and envision that with, you know, now it's adorable. You know, my grand, she's got macular degeneration. There we go. And, you know, she takes my arm. She can't see as well. And we giggle about me helping her with her zip, because I remember her doing my zip.
Yeah.
And I think to myself in those moments, man, this is the cycle of life. And yet, you know, if you're a caregiver, there's, you know, we're fortunate. It's not a crime to know the limitations of what you can and cannot do. And I think there's that piece too that comes into it. I love what your family said too. We don't want to live in your four walls, but we'll live around you. I love that. There's such honesty in that. And that's the healthy boundaries you're talking about. But what are your thoughts on when a family encounters that heartbreaking moment where no one is really equipped nor has the emotional capacity to cope with that? That's heartbreaking. You know, something that goes sideways, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
Or not even sideways, normal. Yeah. Normal aging, where we lose our faculties, you know?
Absolutely. And also, I agree with you and want to speak to that point about, you know, we're very fortunate and lucky that we have not only the relationships that we have, that everybody can and wants to live together, but that we actually in proximity all live on Vancouver Island. Our children have lived all over the world and come home, purposefully come home to live together. It's not possible for everyone, nor does everybody want to live with their brother or has a great relationship with their mother, or actually can be part or has capacity or can financially or spiritually, emotionally, or physically be with someone at end of life, right? Or even as they age. Yeah. And what I say to people is, you don't have to live this way. You need to, though, think about what the plan is or what your plan is in terms of how can you be a part of that if you want to be? And if you don't want to be, how can you be on the outside of that and still be okay with it and support yourself and provide whatever you need for yourself to get through it? Because you will be going through that process regardless of whether you're at the bedside or a thousand miles away, right? Whether you have a relationship with that person or you don't, you will be affected in whatever way, you know, it's true for you in their death. So I say to people, just make a plan. Don't wait. What happens, or what I would see also in palliative is, you know, the daughter getting the call and having to race out the door, leave her children and her job for a number of weeks or days, rush, you know, to the West Coast to say goodbye without either having a plan, but also with it being either sudden or unexpected or interrupting that sort of daily flow of life and not being part of that daily flow of life, right? And so I would just say to people, find a way to start thinking about it now. You know, we've had those conversations in our family. I have brothers, one who lives here, one who lives far away. I already know that the one who lives here, I'll be with, and the one who is far away, I won't be necessarily with, but he has the people that he needs. And I'll be here in whatever capacity I can. I'll be part of that process if I can. I'll be there at the end if I can. But I likely won't be there for months and months and months. Whereas here with my brother here, I likely will be part of it. You know, and so we've had those conversations. And so they're all well right now.
Yes.
And I have capacity, but I know there are people who don't have capacity. And then they need to find the people who do. And then they just need to find the way to find support for themselves in that journey, because they are going through it regardless of whether they're with the person or not. Right. And I think we need to be honest with ourselves. I think it just comes back to being honest. If you don't,
and healthy boundaries.
Not everybody wants to care for someone. Nor do you need to. It's not your job, right? It's not your job. But I think we do have a duty to be real about it and be clear about it and to express in the most, you know, in the kindest way possible, this is what I'm available and able to do, and this is what I'm not.
Yes.
And be true to that.
Yeah. Right?
And then put things in place to support that other person if you can, but to support yourself.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. I'm going to ask about, so don't let me forget to ask you about death doulas, because it occurs to me that, you know, that's a perfect intersection for us to, you know, explore that conversation. But before I do that, you know, it occurs to me that sometimes what plays out is unresolved relationship that stops up this process and interferes with that planning, you know, unresolved guilt or unresolved relationships. And, you know, those kind of get in the way and muddy the waters of the planning. They're, you know, caring for someone out of obligation, like, is a kind of a sad experience for both the receiver and the, you know, the giver, right? And those are interchangeable in a relationship. Yeah. So, and I think, doing your work, and I love what you said about, you know, that individual getting supported, get supported with that to heal that thing so that you, this is, you know, maybe you'll put your piece in here of that. But my opinion is, you know, get supported to do your work, to resolve that. And that's, you know, kind of like the divine intervention of the two of you locked in this moment in time of the journey of, you know, the person that's dying or the one that we're creating the plan for. Yeah, it's like there's some divine intervention there where you're both at that tension point, and to get supported to heal that, and then is a release to then allow that death to occur with those things resolved. What are your thoughts
there? Yes. Yeah. You know what I think? I think that what happens is those things that we have ignored, like we talked about before, where we haven't faced something or we haven't looked at it or we faked it or whatever it is, like Gaber Mate talks about.
Yes.
I think what happens is that is the time when you can no longer ignore it, because that person that you haven't spoken to for 25 years that you could easily not speak to because maybe you live far away or maybe you don't see them in your everyday life or you've long forgotten why you don't talk. Now it's right in front of you. So if you have not done the work, you know, Byron Katie talks about the work. If you have not done the work, then you are going to be smack dab right in front of that relationship that didn't, that is not, you know, the way maybe you would have liked it to have been, or that you have ignored, or that you have simply not dealt with in whatever way you need to. And so, unfortunately, even though it's not the best time, because there's all this other stuff going on with this other person, you know, at nearing end of life, you don't have any more, I don't think you have any more choice, right? I think you have to deal with it at that point. Of course you can say no, but that's the perfect time to, yes, you have to, you know, come to terms with that person dying, but what you really need to come to terms with is your own relationship to yourself and to that person. And then you need to do the work, and you can do that work alongside somebody who's dying, even if you're not with them, right? Because you yourself, by doing that work, will have your own better death. Like there is no right time to do something until it's the right time when it's the right time for you. So if it takes you 40 years to come to terms with something, or you only face it, you know, your relationship with your mother, because now you've got the call, that's okay. This, everything happens in the perfect moment, even when it's not perfect. This is the time. So then you start to do your work.
Absolutely.
Right? And I just say, call in your guides, call in your angels, call in your ancestors, call in your support, because there are all kinds of people just waiting for you to call so that they can come in and support you. We are not alone ever. We are not alone.
Yeah. No, you're absolutely, yes. And oh, we are so connected.
All of us, right? You and I, and all of us, we are all connected. Yes. Yeah. No one walks alone, right?
No.
Like Ram Dass, we are all just walking each other home, right? Yeah. We are together. Even when we're apart, we are together.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Absolutely. So profound. And, which actually then is a perfect segue for death doulas. Speaking of walking people home.
Yes.
Amazing work. Would you share a little about, you know, your experience with death doulas and the notion of it?
Yes. So I've known about death doulas for a while now, but I learned a lot more about death doulas in the group that Shauna Jan started, the Victoria Holistic Death Care Group, because there were death doulas in the group. And it just makes perfect sense. You know how sometimes there's an idea or a concept or something comes up and you think, How could we not have thought of this? We have birth doulas. Yeah. We help people into the world. Why would we not help people out of the world? Like, it just makes so much sense, right? To walk alongside and to support someone. And especially in cases where we don't have friends or family or caregivers or someone who can be with us, a death doula can walk that walk with us, right? And so, and now there's such an emerging group, like it's just blowing up now, the number of people who come forward who have chosen or been spirit led to do this work. And I honestly believe that that everyone who's doing this work must be spirit led, because this is not something that you choose. This is something that chooses you for sure, is to walk alongside someone and to support them in whatever way. And sometimes death doulas are supporting the person who's at end of life, but they're also supporting family and caregivers and people who are supporting them. And they are walking alongside, and they can not only help physically being present, but they help with like calling in all the other supports, right? They are wonderful at providing resources, and they're wonderful at being with people, helping with ceremony and ritual, like all aspects. And what's beautiful about it is death doulas work with you according to what you want. So you actually get to say, this is how I would like, you know, this is what I'd like it to look like, or this is would be my best death. And then death doulas can help you bring that about, right? That's what they do. And then they walk alongside you, and then they stay with you and with your family and support and whatever, and caregivers afterwards too. So they're part of the entire journey, and death doulas can start with you. Yeah. You know, the definition of palliative, we used to think of people as palliative or needing hospice, like days, you know, weeks, maybe months. Now we're looking at palliative like 2 years or longer, right? So you can, you can have palliative support and people working with you for years before you die, which is beautiful, how it should be, right? It's not about the last 2 weeks. It's about, you know, a large part of the journey, right?
Yeah.
So, you know, there's some amazing people doing some amazing work in the death doula industry. And I'm just so glad that we're coming to a place of acceptance for this type of work. Yeah, it's so important. Yeah.
Absolutely. Yeah. And, you know, and I think this obviously comes from a particular relationship to death myself, which I've been taking on, you know, actively, is like when we think about a death doula and the amazing skill set that they have, and just in awe, you know, of what they can hold and be with.
Yes.
Amazing. Yes. To provide such an incredible service, and how brilliant. Because, you know, in 98, I had a brush with cancer. And at the time, there was some fuzziness around my diagnosis where it wasn't immediately obvious that I was going to be fine. And I had two little kids, 6 and 8. And my biggest fear in that moment of the, you know, those nightmare 2 weeks where I thought, wow, this is it. And I'm only what? I was like in my early 30s. My only thought was, what is the plan for the kids, and what, you know, who will continue? And so to have a death doula to put that piece to rest, I really see where I could have reached an acceptance, you know, of, albeit sad.
Yes.
But, you know, it would have been easier.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. Well, they and like you said about their skill set, like they have so many beautiful things to offer, you know, just in holding space for somebody is such a wonderful, wonderful gift. Right. And then all the other things that they can bring to someone's passing. I mean, I think the service is just amazing. Yeah. And the people, as I said, they must be divinely led or spirit led, because there's no way other way they could do this work.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Amazing humans. There's a thought that popped to my mind, and that is that being with death and someone who has expired, there's so much mystery around it. I had the misfortune, and perhaps fortune, of working for a police department in the identification unit, where I actually, on my lunch hours, I actually think I should have been a, you know, forensic, and, you know, some description of forensics, but investigator or something, But I used to sit on my lunch hour and flip through books on, you know, various stages of decomposition and what we look like and what actually happens. And, you know, the shrouded in mystery adds to the fear and the, you know, concern whether we're caring for someone or whether it's us or, you know, I imagine a death doula supports with here's the things you can expect and, you know, here's what happens and here's how you can tell. And I've actually had the fortune of talking with my partner who's an occupational therapist and worked on cadavers and also, you know, walked their own parent through the pearly gates. And, you know, there's, yeah, so I do have a little bit of insider scoop, but what would you say to people and how to learn about that process to shed light on something like where we're you're still shrouded in mystery and a little bit of don't talk about that, you know?
Yeah, so I think now I think more than ever, we're so lucky because we have so many places where we can find information and where we can find people and where we can find the support we need. So first of all, I would obviously say the Deathly Matters Conference, because I mean, that this is the types of things that we talk about, right? We talk about the mystery, we talk about sort of all the things outside of the mainstream conversation, right? Which is, you know, beyond death and crossing the veil and calling in our ancestors and all of those things and all the ceremony and ritual that can be attached to end of life. So I would say that places like the Deathly Matters Conference, but also there are so many resources now, right? So all of the, I mean, you just have to Google it. I mean, even all the hospices and palliative care centers, all the grief workers, all the death doula industry, you know, the Death Doula Association, all of these groups have all kinds of resources that you can just reach out to and learn, right? And sort of help you figure out the mystery or the parts of the mystery that are available to us to figure out, right, on this side. So it's all there now, whereas before it would have been harder to find and maybe we wouldn't have talked about it so much. But I just feel now like it's becoming so much more normalized and so much more part of our conversation. I have people email me all the time or write and say, is there someone who does this type of work? Or this might be an unusual request, but do you know anybody who does this? And always there is a yes. You know, I don't even have to search very far to say, here's four people that do that kind of work. This is not that unusual. You know, here's someone who can help you build a casket. Here's somebody who can teach you about crossing the veil. Here's a medium who can speak to you or maybe can channel, you know, the person that you've lost. There's just so much available now.
Yes.
So I don't think we have to reach very far, to be honest, to find what we need and to get answers. Yeah.
Yeah. Interesting.
I'm not sure if that answers your question.
Yeah, no, it absolutely did. I think that that was my question was, what are the resources available? And is it, you know, now becoming widespread that you can just simply Google it? Of course you can. You can Google everything. Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, absolutely. But, you know, thankfully that people have had the thinking and the selflessness to learn and, like yourself, become a resource and then, you know, to post these resources and to have these things immediately available. Because again, that's busting up old culture of don't talk about it. Or, you know, obviously there is other cultures who do death much better than Western culture does. And, you know, getting back to that or learning from them by their grace will support us to develop a new and, you know, healthier approach.
Yes. Sure. And I think, becoming comfortable with reaching out, right? Death is personal, but it doesn't need to be private. You can say, I am struggling. This is what I need, or I don't even know what I need. You know, what's out there? What do you think, you know, who do you think, and what do you think can help me? And I just think we are getting closer and closer to a place where this is everyday talk and could be everyday talk, right? You know, we have in the death group that I work with, we have people who are trying to get it into the school system, trying to get it into the curriculum. Talk to children, talk to our teens, right? Let's have, and that speaks, that to me, that speaks or goes back to that idea of multi-generational, because if you have elders and you have all different ages, then you have all different stories and lived experience. So then you have elders telling you the story about, wow, when my grandma died, this is what we, and then you can, little kids can be like, really? She was in the room. You can ask those questions, right?
Yes.
And you can learn from, if we just, you know, sit in ourselves or with our own age group or with our own you know, like-minded people, there's not as much room for growth and expansion and learning, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. I think, you know, we come back to over and over again in this conversation, this deep need for us to A, own that we are one and that we are all connected.
Absolutely.
And two, you know, physically connect. And we had the occasion to visit Kansas a few years ago, and I'd never been there and was delighted to see the common home have no boundaries. They have no fences. There's just these endless yards of space and grass touching grass and neighbors living in community. I was just blown away by that. I was like, wow, what a concept. You know, it would really, beginning to come back to that, less boundaries, less borders. But that's a whole other story too for me in terms of like boundaries and borders. And I think.
When you were saying that, it reminded me of the keynote speaker we had for our first conference, Roseanne Buthan, who worked with medical assistance in dying on the island and is an amazing, amazing and beautiful woman. And one of the things that she said in her keynote was that we are each other. And I think about that often when I am when I'm walking downtown and I see someone who's living on the street, or when I'm listening to somebody maybe in a particular setting, like I'm in a shop or something and I hear someone having an argument, or I hear someone speaking unkindly to someone, or I see someone who looks different than me or talks different than me. And I try to bring myself always back to this idea that I am that person. I am the person homeless on the street. I am the person who I don't necessarily like maybe what they're saying or you know, don't necessarily agree with their conversation. We are each other, right? And, and the only way that we are going to be able to survive on the planet is if we continue to believe that we are one with each other, we are connected, and we need to be supporting each other and lifting each other up, right? We do not need to be alone, nor are we meant to.
Yeah.
Right? We need to be interdependent, woven into each other's lives in whatever way is comfortable for us and works
absolutely.
For us.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I think that, you know, Stephen Porges talks about that, you know, the polyvagal theory. I had an absolute delight in listening to that man speak and following his work, you know, and his great wisdom and experience and research. And just that it all comes back to connection, that we have gone through this period of time where our world is so desperately separated. That's actually, and I really have a belief about addiction and homelessness that's very much aligned with Gabor Maté's work. And that is, you know, we may not necessarily be deeply connected or in connection with our own, you know, biological family, but connecting to others and caring for others and, you know, loving others. Like, how can we not, when I feel like it's rejecting a part of us when we don't give love and we can't see that addiction is born from lack of love. And if we could just get down to the brass tacks of giving love, then perhaps we could, you know, put an end to addiction, that we could end homelessness if we could begin there rather than you know, addressing the symptoms. And there's some great people out there doing amazing work in addiction and homelessness. And I know we're on our way. We're maybe at the beginning of our journey, and I hope maybe a little further along, but there, I really have a belief that it comes back to dismantling those fences. And really, you know, I feel like that's a little part of COVID's gift, because I noticed us out at the end of our driveways, distance, because we were all locked in at one point and locked down to our homes, and, you know, getting outside went the length of our driveways, and our neighbors were doing the same thing. So we got to learn about illnesses, and we would never have known that necessarily, although we're very chatty Surprise, surprise. We're not those neighbors, but yeah, you know, it just was a massive opportunity to hear what's going on all around us and to be able to say, hey, if you need us, we're here. We are the cup of sugar neighbor.
Right? Absolutely. Yes. Yes. And the other thing that I think COVID did was it allowed people, in fact, it caused people to pause in their busyness. And I think that lots of people had to face things and reflect on, had an opportunity to reflect on things and had time to think about things.
Yeah.
Even the space they were in, like, do I want to be in this space? Do you know what I mean? Because they could not rush out and be busy doing. I think there was a lot more being that happened during COVID. And I think that there will be a lot of fallout with people making new life choices, I think. Yeah. Because they had time and sort of didn't have really much opportunity other than to sit with themselves.
Yes.
We're not good at that. We're not so good at sitting with ourselves. We're much better doers than beers.
Absolutely. We put a lot of doing in our space so as to not be with that part of ourselves. And
I know
my journey is not that. It's all about, I like to call it playfully, navel gazing.
Yeah.
But definitely being an observer of my behavior and addressing all of those parts of me yet unhealed and taking them on actively has been an incredible journey. And in the very beginning, terrifying. I didn't want to look there.
Yes.
But now, obviously, a degree of muscle in it. And it's really just about getting started in it, isn't it?
Yeah. Yes. Yeah. Connecting to self. I mean, we just need to connect to ourselves. Yeah. Before we can connect to others, actually.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Linda, you're an amazing human. Is there anything we haven't touched on that you would love to bring into our conversation?
I think we've touched on most of it. I think it's really simple. I just think we overcomplicate things. And I just think that people need to really walk in kindness and with compassion. And I know people say those words all the time, but I honestly think if we could get up in the morning, with gratitude, with a sense of gratitude, and then walk in kindness and compassion. And I was talking to someone the other day and they were having a difficult conversation at work. And I said, you know, what I do now, and I've done for a while now, is I simply assume that every person I meet is struggling in some way, has some form of trauma, has some level of grief, has some level of pain, and wants to connect in some way. And so if you approach every situation and every person with that, and I know it's difficult, it's part of the human condition, this is what we're learning, how can you not have a better result, and how can you not have a better moment in time, and how can we not be better to each other if we just simply approach everybody from a place of kindness, right?
Yeah.
Sort of take ourselves out of the situation, and if we can really believe that we are each other, I just think it's a better way to live, and I just think the planet will be a better place.
I love it.
I think it'll be a better place. Yeah,
absolutely.
Love is always the answer. That is the line that we've used in our family for years, and we believe it. Love is always the answer.
Absolutely.
Yeah. And before we go, can I just tell you my three questions?
Of course you can. Yeah. I was saving the best for last.
People who know me already know these questions, and anyone who's listening who knows me will be like, oh yeah, the three questions. But anyway, these are the three questions that I and some members of our family have asked each other all our lives in order to make decisions, both small and large, life-changing decisions too. And the questions are, what am I afraid of? Is the first question. And a lot of people would say, what am I resisting? But when you resist something, I always think of your brain. But when you are afraid of something, I think of your heart. So I think it's easier to ask ourselves, what am I afraid of in this moment? And the next question we ask ourselves is, what would love do here? Because really, all the questions that I ask and all the answers that I receive and all the ways that I live my life, I want them to be based on love. So I ask myself, what am I afraid of? What would love do here? And then the third question we ask ourselves is, what is the best possible outcome? Because human nature says, what is the worst case scenario? We always go to the worst case scenario.
Devil's advocate, right?
Why don't we go to the best case scenario? Because likely that is exactly what will happen. Rarely do all those negative and worst case things happen, right? So I think if no matter what we're trying to decide, if we just ask ourselves those three questions, What am I afraid of? What would love do here? What's the best possible outcome? Mm. The answer has always worked for me. No matter what, the answer we get is always the one we follow, and it's always worked. Hasn't always been exactly what we wanted, but it's
right.
But it's always been exactly what we needed.
Beautiful. I love that. Brilliant.
Yeah.
People are going to want to know how to sign up for your family. We'll post your details. No, I just easy. Yeah. Well, that, you know, this is such an amazing place for us to complete our conversation. I always feel as though talking further would just muddy those beautiful waters, you know, like it's, thank you so much for gracing us with your presence, which is grace all over the place, for shining a light and normalizing a beautiful conversation, for probably warming hearts and bringing love to people that may be facing death, that may be experiencing it with a loved one that I really have at this conversation is just, you're sharing your gifts, you're sharing your experience, and it's a beautiful thing that you're doing.
Oh, thank you so much. I'd like to say that I so appreciate you reaching out to me and wanting to share time and space together, because I really believe we have a short time on the planet. I know everyone says it, and time is sacred, and I'm very intentional about how I spend it. And I know you are too. And I feel so honored that you chose to spend this amount of time with me. Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Gratitude and love to you.
You too, Linda. You're amazing, doing incredible work and living an amazing life. Thanks for all the work you've taken on for you too. It's just beautiful. You have been witnessing me, and my confession is that I've been almost in a puddle of tears over here and just listening to you. So you really touched my heart today. And yeah, I'm sure our listeners are going to experience their hearts touched and expanded in some brilliant way as a result of this discussion. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Blessings to all.
I hope you've enjoyed this episode of Talk to Tea with Linda Hunter. If you haven't done so already, don't forget to subscribe and always leave room for a little magic in your life.